Well, could you talk some, just a tiny bit more about this having people stand up? I'm just picturing you go over to, you know, you go over to Noam's house and you say, "Sorry, Noam, you got to stand up now." And
no, I don't do that.
Yeah, I know. The interviews, but you're saying that you would do that with some people.
Not for interviews.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for recording speeches or debates and those kinds of situations, I think you can generate a lot more energy. The dynamic in an interview is more, it's a conversation, it's a give and take. It's not a stand up and deliver. You know, this is the Dharma. This is how I see the world. This is my view of racism. This is my view of structural capitalism. This is how I see the media. That's a stand up and deliver kind of thing. So the context is different in a conversation. Now you'll see with Chomsky when he speaks on Tuesday night, he's not a charismatic speaker. He doesn't use modulation. He's got a monotone voice. What makes Chomsky attractive to so many people, particularly in the U.S. and Canada, is the sheer weight of his argument and the density and the power of his information. His ability to master a disparate amount of information from a wide variety of sources, synthesize it for us, and present it. So that's not oratory. That's a very different thing. I mean, you could hardly imagine Chomsky doing a kind of Ron Daniels performance. you know,
interesting to watch him try.
It would. You know, it's a very different style, and so you need to be aware of what people's capacities are, you know, in terms of that. Angela Davis, for example, she could read from the phone book and you'd be bouche bée, your jaw would drop. What a voice, what an instrument, you know, just spectacular. I did a program with Martine Espada on poetry and politics. He's a Puerto Rican, U.S. born, Puerto Rican origin writer and poet. He teaches at UMass Amherst. Great voice, great delivery, wonderful modulation, peaks. Why do I mean modulation? Peaks and valleys. You know, when that meter is doing things. It's not just staying in one spot all the time, not moving at all in a very straight kind of way. Again, it doesn't create the audio patterns that might, you know, bring in listeners to say, yeah, I want to hear what this person has to say. This sounds really interesting. So that's, you know, being sensitive to those kinds of things is really important. About the interview style, everyone has their own style. You should be listening to people, reading their interviews, listening to them on the CBC or public radio or WBAI in New York or whatever, and see what other people are doing. I mean, I learned a lot as a kid growing up. I didn't know I was doing this, but I was addicted to Edward R. Murrow and Mike Wallace. Mm. And I would watch all their, you know, news documentaries and interview shows, and I was just seeing what they were doing, how they were, like, improvising. How did they keep it going? I mean, I found that so, you know, live broadcast. These are not, like, you know, pre-recorded, taped. You know, you cut and paste, and then everybody sounds really smart. You know, there are no uhs and dead air or anything like that. And I was just fascinated to see, you know, the ability, just in terms of pacing, to forward an agenda. Maybe I didn't agree with the content at all. And in most cases, you know, particularly today with the corporate controlled media, I hate the way they do things. I despise Charlie Rose. He's just awful. Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour is the most boring interview anywhere in North America. I mean, it's hard to, you know, he's really in a class by himself. He said, there should be a statute of limitations on boredom. I don't know how these guys get jobs and then keep them. How do they keep them? How does Charlie Rose keep a job? When he gets Edward Said on the air, he doesn't let Said speak, finish sentence, because he doesn't agree with him. When he gets someone on that he agrees with, like Thomas Friedman, you know, saying that, you know, Arabs are terrorists, they like to kill little girls and school children, they have nothing better to do like to blow up buses. And the Rose is there, you know, nodding, because he's agreeing. When he gets on someone, when the guest is someone like he disagrees with, he can't finish a sentence. What about? Oh, yeah, right. What about this professor? What about those little kids that were, you know, all those kinds of things. You know, where he would never interrupt Friedman and say, well, what about these Palestinian homes that were bulldozed? What about this land that was annexed over here? What about these? What about this five-month-old baby that was shot? How do you explain that? Never asked. So, I mean, there you see ideology also intersecting with interviewing. But it's also a very bad technique, you know, because you're not really providing the listener with any kind of background, with any kind of, some energy, you know, into the situation, rather saying, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the most deadly, unthinking comments, if you really want to turn people off, you know, and you tell you know, you're right. Those are my thoughts exactly. Or, I'm sure our listeners agree. Deadly with six E's at the end. Deadly. Or, you know, I'm sure everybody knows that. How do you know that? Do you know that Regina is the capital of Saskatchewan? Most listeners don't. Or do you know that the NDP party was just crushed in British Columbia? You know, most Americans don't know that kind of stuff. So you can't make statements like, I'm sure everybody knows, or it's well known. How is it well known? I mean, there's some obvious things, you know, like B follows A. You don't have to say that. But some things are not well known. Like, do people know the differences between GMOs and HMOs? Let's say I'm doing an interview here and we're talking about GMOs and HMOs. Well, can we have a definition of what those things are? Once, please, just to get that in circulation. So let's say he's a scientist and you know he's using technical terms and GATT this and NAFTA that and FTA this and GMOs that. You need to be there for the audience, not for yourself. So you're smart. You know all these acronyms. But yeah, you know, who is your average listener or reader? You have to think about them and not show that, you know, you're so clever and you're so smart. Well, GMO, what is that? You know, what does GMO stand for? Or if you know, does genetically modified organisms, right?
So is that what you do? You'll kind of come in and you'll say, can you explain that? Is that how you'll do it?
What's a GMO? What's the difference between GMO and MO? Okay. You know, HMO. Is GATT part of the WTO? And what does GATT stand for?
General Agreement on Trade Tariffs.
Chomsky gets the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. He always pluralizes the investments. And it's not, it's a singular. Multilateral Agreement on Investment. It's a pretty common mistake. NAI. Yeah.
One of the reasons of doing those kind of things, tell us what that means, you know, if somebody makes a kind of an arcane thing, is you're trying to recruit new listeners, too. You may have some regular listeners that have followed this issue, but you're not going to grow the audience if you're assuming that just the core set are the ones that are, you know, how are the new people going to be tapped in and catch on with this stuff and getting to repeat that definition?
So seeing your role, who are you? Are you this really smart person, and you may be, that is very informed about corporate media? Last Saturday, let me give you a perfect example. My sitar teacher was visiting me in Boulder. I'd studied Indian music in a past life. And I was going to do an interview with him. And I had to convince him to see me as a total blank, someone absolutely ignorant that knew nothing about Indian music. Because I was going to ask him these kind of, you know, leading questions. Well, what's a raga? How did this music evolve? Why is it that Indian music, certain ragas are played at a certain time? What's the idea behind that? It was difficult for him. In the first 15 minutes, twice he said, as you know. See, he lost that. He lost seeing me as a blank wall, and then he started seeing me as David, his student, who had studied with him for many years, who knew all these things. Right? So I stopped, because it wasn't a live interview, I stopped the tape recorder. And this is one advantage of a, you know, pre-recorded and not live. And I just told him, I said, you got to see, I know nothing. See me as a blank wall. And then he didn't do it again for the rest of the hour. And so I did that interview on Indian music, a rather obscure topic. And so I was asking very leading questions the kinds of questions you would ask. What is a raga? How is it expressed? You know, what is the background of this music? What is the history of the sitar? How many strings does it? You know, stuff like that. Leading questions to draw out answers. It wasn't an antagonistic interview, you know, in a way, because it was a more of a cultural interview. So it wasn't like, how do you know that? What's the evidence? Can you give some example? Well, that is an ongoing question, you know. If he says, you know, Indian music is very spiritual, how is it spiritual? You know, can you give an example? You know, is it spiritual in theory but not in practice? I mean, how do you articulate spirituality in your plectrum when you strum a string? That's actually a very hard question. You know, but again, it's a good question because it's drawing out, you know, examples. And because a cultural interview is different from a political interview, you know, it has a different flavor to it. Yeah?
I've noticed in television interviews the technique that sometimes it seems like there's an awkward silence, and then that will cause the person being interviewed to say something really, what you really want them to, you know, to go beyond. But can you do that in radio?
If there's a silence?
Yeah, can there be any kind of silence?
Silence is good. I'm not afraid of silence. I'm much more critical of silence fillers, like you know what I really want to ask you is the other day I was thinking about would you mind if you know, those kinds of things? Why are you trying to formulate a question? Yeah. You're just filling the air with dead air, with deadness. You know, and I'm not afraid. I think we can use silences, you know? Like when I was interviewing my mother, which was the very first interview I ever did, and probably the most difficult interview, because when you're interviewing a loved one, you know, someone who's close to you, you know, about something very painful, because she went through the massacres in 1915 in Armenia, and I got her to describe, you know, how she had to abandon her parent. Now, as I'm saying it, I'm like, losing it, just telling you. You know, so it was very, when she talked about that, there was silence, and I didn't say anything. Because that should sink into people. Right? That she abandoned her mother and her three, I can't even replicate it. Her three younger brothers left on the roadside to die. Because they were just too ill to continue. And so just let that be. Don't fill it with some inane, you know, comment. And be sensitive to that moment. You know, and not like go on to some, you know. And then when you come to the United States, you know, or, and you met your husband later and got married, what was that like? Duh. You know. I mean, being able to improvise is, you know, important, and being sensitive. The art of doing an interview is also being a very good listener. Mm-hmm. Listening for the cracks and crevices in people's voices. Like, if you were interviewing me right now, I just gave you an enormous opening. You know, why was I, like, breaking up there for a few seconds? Is this, like, profoundly, am I profoundly connected to that material? Yes. So that would give you an opening. Trying to find those, and also trying to ask the questions that, with my mother was very difficult because she knew I knew everything about it. You know, why were we doing this interview? Well, I was doing, it was a historical archive kind of thing. I wanted to get this recorded before she died. So, you know, it was serving that purpose. So it was, I had to do the same thing I did with my sitar teacher. You are not talking to me. You are talking to a blank wall. You know, like, I know why the genocide happened, but I need to ask you why you think it happened. Things like that. So, you know, when I asked you that initial question about, you know, have you ever done any interviews? You've all done interviews, but they haven't been formalized. You're interviewing everyone all the time at the, you know, at the dinner line at Swopes. Where are you from? You know, how'd you hear about ZMI? You know, the kinds of questions. Those are all interviews. I mean, it's not formalized, it's not for broadcast, it's not for print, but we are conversing, we are interrogating That's what interviewing is about. And so it should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You should have an agenda. And this, you know, don't get confused about this. You are the director. You're in charge of this art form. And you want to take it from a certain place and get to a certain place. You don't want to have a half an hour as, for example, let's say you have a 30-minute program. And I heard this actually. It's right off of Democracy Now! Amy Goodman had Chomsky on. This is how she began the final question. Noam, first of all, to call someone by their first name in an interview, no matter if you're very intimate with them, is very off-putting to the audience because it shows a friendship and a personal relationship that immediately says, oh, they're tight, man.
They're buds.
They're buds. They're cool. You know, they're having a private conversation. So, you know, I've interviewed, you know, Chomsky, you know, 800 times. As soon as the mic goes on, he's Noam Chomsky. I don't say, hey, Noam, you know, what's shaking, dude? Yeah. Maybe I should.
Just once.
That would really throw him off. But for the listener, you want to create distance. So with a minute left, Noam, we've got about 30 seconds left.
What? Yeah.
What is your theory about linguistics?
Do you really think that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's a great question. That's a good question, perfectly legitimate. But think about the architecture of your program now, where you are. You're almost at the top of the pyramid. You've run out of time. You know any kind of answer is going to be very complicated and necessarily verbose. You know, I mean, this is not like, you know, where, you know, what's the title of your next book? Oh, Propaganda in the Public Mind. Great. Okay, done. That could be your last question. So, strategic error. That kind of question needs to come at the bottom of the pyramid.
Could you talk more about
that? As you're working your way up in terms of time. A theory of linguistics is not a simple question or answer. Like, you know, what was the last movie you saw? What's the next book you're reading? You know, what are you having for lunch? I mean, those are like one-liners. You can get them out of the way. And those, you know, good ways to end interviews. You know, what book are you working on a new book? Or you're in Madison, you're interviewing Chomsky, you know, live at WRT. Where are you going to from Madison? Oh, my next stop is Boulder. I'm going to be giving a talk there at the university tomorrow night. Yeah, okay, so it gives it some closure. Yeah, somebody had...
Well, I was just wondering, could you talk more about this pyramid? You know, I know people talk about an inverted pyramid for, like, newspaper writing. What are you talking about?
Well, that's... You know, I'm using it as a metaphor. You know, maybe you can create something that you're more comfortable with. But I'm looking at an interview that has a base at the beginning and where you have a minimalist and a maximalist agenda of questions. You've got a half hour or one hour, right? In that, let's just work with a half hour format. You've got your five questions that you've absolutely got to get in. Okay. The royal family of Nepal has just been assassinated. Professor Sin, you know, what's the background to this issue? What is the media saying about it that, you know, that we're not hearing? What are your personal views on this topic? What prompted? Let's say you have like five basic questions that you want to get out for your audience. Then if those questions are answered satisfactorily and they don't generate other questions, and you're still watching the clock, you're still managing the clock, you can now move to your maximalist agenda. You know, where you can flesh out more things about the history of the monarchy in Nepal. What is the relationship between India and Nepal? Which is actually a good question because it's very contentious. People in Nepal feel that India is a hegemon. It's an imperial power. It's dominating Nepal. And, you know, so, like the way most of the third world sees the U.S., except for Americans who don't see themselves that way. So that relationship between India and Nepal. So you move then to, and you're watching this, you're watching the clock, you're setting an agenda, you're trying to move, you have a trajectory of ideas, and you want to have closure at the end. So a question on Nepal, let's say this massacre, that would not be, you know, like, what can people do about this issue, is not a good closure question, because there's not much we can do about it. It's an internal matter unique to that situation. But let's say, and you know, I'll be interviewing Vandana Shiva in a couple of weeks, and we're talking about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and you know what's happening with the corporatization of food. There, a closure question, you know, one to sort of end it with toward a trajectory is, well, you know, what can people do about it? Because you know that there are organizations, both national and international, that are working on this particular issue, like in Canada, the Council of Canadians, for example, or Public Citizen, or, you know, Third World Resurgence in Penang. There are all kinds of national and international organizations that are working on this particular issue. So you can say, you can go to their website, you can buy this book, you can read South End Press, Stolen Harvest. There are practical things that people can do. Some things don't lend them, you know, some topics don't lend themselves. Like if I were to do this thing on Nepal, I was just thinking about that, just improvising. You know, there's not much anyone can do in this room about that. I mean, you could get the information, you could suss it out, you could figure out, you know, what the motives were, what the implications are. There's not much we can do sitting in Woods Hole, you know. But there are things we can do about the U.S. media. There are things we can do about corporate control. There are things we can do about GMOs, yes. There are things we can do about the city council that passed a resolution last night, you know, imposing a 10 o'clock curfew on teenagers, which has happened in certain U.S. cities. Yes.
If your last question turns out to spark too much of a comment and you're running out of time and you really got to cut somebody off, do you have any advice for how to stop somebody who doesn't seem to be pausing and, you know, tell them, like, our time's up?
Well, yeah, if you're holding them, if it's a radio interview, it's pretty simple. You know, we're like, well, we're running out of time now.
Just take it away.
Yeah, yeah.
Mid-sentence, if need be.
If need be. Yeah, no, the clock is driving you. The program that I do, Alternative Radio, it's on the satellite. It's not more than 58 minutes. It can't be more than 58 minutes because the satellite channel literally clears and you get... So if you're a radio station downloading my program in Martha's Vineyard or wherever, or in New York, and, you know, it's 58:02, I'm in mid-sentence and I'm... you just can't do it.
Do you make sure that the person you're interviewing, if you're live, can see the clock and, you know, is watching?
You're managing the clock.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you're managing. And also, one thing you should also do is, if you're going to use any hand signals, make them clear in advance, not while you're going along. I did it in a live interview once on the air. I did this, which meant, you know, like, wind it up, close it down, and the guy stopped in mid-sentence because I didn't rehearse signals, you know, like cut or stop, you know, like I want to ask a question, you know, like stop. So if you're going to do any hand signals, they should know about it, you know, in advance. No surprises. Again, you know, it's live. Live is like healthy panic, right? You know, live is, you know, it's good because it's healthy panic, but it also it's fraught with danger because you could really crash. You know, if these kinds of things happen when you're pre-recording, let's say, you know, we're doing a, you know, pre-recorded interview now, we can stop and start, we can edit, cut and paste, you know, make the interviewee sound really coherent. So if the question starts in Halifax and ends in Victoria, you know, it's too long of a question. So you compress it and just stop it at, let's say, Toronto. So you have this question here, right there. Danger points that interviewers fall into is being a prisoner of verbosity or their own cleverness, you know, and want to impress the audience. You know, I know everything about this topic. I've studied it carefully. I've actually got a PhD in it, and I've written several books. And, you know, my opinion is actually this. And do you agree? So, now here you have a total confusion of the role of the interviewer and the interviewee. In this case, I want to be on the other side. I want to be the pundit. I want to be the one that's being interviewed. I don't want to be the interviewer because I'm so smart and I know everything. You know, so that is something you see a lot of in interviews. And one of the things, here's the text of an interview I did with Edward Said a couple of weeks ago in Santa Fe. And you have the interview I did with Stuart Ewan in the packet I handed out to you. You can see there should be a nice architecture between question and answer. You know, if you see a question this long and the answer this short, just as a musician, there's some dissonance here. You're out of tune big time. That architecture is not right. You're taking up too much of the musical space, and the guest is not participating enough. So you want to actually, when you have a transcription like this, you want to see question, response, question, response, question, response. It keeps the focus on the interviewee. That's who you're paying attention to, not to yourself. This is not an opportunity to show how smart you are. You want to be informed. You know, you don't want to say, is Toronto the capital of Canada? You should come to the table knowing that I think probably most Americans think Toronto is the capital of Canada because it's the largest city. But, you know, you want to come to the table informed about Ottawa being the capital, and it's a parliamentary system, not who's the head of your Congress. So you want to have some homework done in advance to cut off a lot of, dead air. Yeah.
You gave an example of how Charlie Rose will interrupt and try
if he doesn't agree with someone.
And you've given examples of how you get someone to elaborate, but if someone's taken off on a tangent that you really don't want to go on, how do you manage?
As you just said, that's a very interesting question, but I want to refocus the topic in the limited amount of time we have. Can we get back to the WTO and its next ministerial meeting in Qatar? What can people do about that? Okay, you know, meanwhile, you've gone off on an article that appeared in your local paper, which you took umbrage to, written by some, activist that you thought was flawed. You know, which, and I don't want to diss you and say, hey, jerk, that's not what we're talking about. It's an interesting topic, but, in the time we have, can we refocus? Can we get back to, so there's a way to deflect that. You know, I could say that, that's interesting, but in the limited amount of time we have, let's get back to the ministerial meeting coming up this fall in Qatar. One nice thing about editing, which I always try and do, is something called block editing, and that's taking out an entire question and answer, rather than internal editing, which is very labor-intensive, very hard to do, and opens up the possibility for lots of errors in terms of audio texture and flow. So if you look at that Stuart Ewan interview, you'll see at the end of it, I put in a thing, due to broadcast requirements, some portions of this interview were not aired, but I included it in the text. It's okay to include it in the text, but when you're up against a satellite structure, or even a live half-hour or one-hour time slot, you don't have certain luxuries.
Should you ever try the other kind, where you're going to take out some sentences of what somebody said and then possibly, likely misconstrue what they're trying to say? Does that open you up to a criticism that you misrepresented what they said? You know, if you shorten their
answer or take out part of it.
Well, if you make an egregious error, and I know you know the answer. If you confuse GMOs with HMOs, for example, I might edit that out and take certain sentences out.
Okay.
But that's very labor intensive. The ear is much more forgiving than the eye. You have to remember that. So now we're talking about print. The eye sees this thing. Look, this is not a sentence. What's the subject? What's the antecedent? What's this dangling participle? What is this sentence that begins here and ends there? I mean, the ear is going to forgive the way I'm speaking right now, kind of like in this, just droning on and on, with occasional complete sentences and complete thoughts, but also dangling participles, no antecedents, you know, no references and things like that, no agreement between pronoun and verb. That the ear will let go. So that's the difference between an audio art and a written art. Like, I'm going to transcribe Ron Daniels' speech from last night, and I'm going to make that into English. But I'm not going to do that for the audio, because someone is speaking. It's okay. So all these interviews in here with Chomsky, we both sound like we're masters of English, because you know it's edited. It's, you know, there's a beginning, there's an end, there's a subject to the sentence, there's a verb. You know, things are explained. There are no run-on sentences and dangling participles, and you know, no modifiers and things like that. So in print, we're able to manipulate the print, and I use manipulate in a good way. You know, we want to come off coherent. We want to come off like, you know. So if I transcribe Daniel's speech verbatim, it'll be virtually unreadable. You know, what was the topic of this sentence? You know, it like began over there, and it seems to be ending, you know, down in, you know, Nantucket.